The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Due to budget issues, Eric's been replaced by a cranky secondhand robot named Dr. Nuts and Bolts.
We assume you won't mind, but if sparks shoot out your radio, you'll know why.
So stand back.
And now, here's Eric 2.0.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. According to my calendar, it's Monday. Monday, do you understand? The weekend is over. You're going to have to come off the beaches. Oh, you weren't on the beaches. We're going to talk about that. With Dave Rubin. Do you know Dave Rubin? He's kind of a big deal in the free speech conservative world. He's got a new book out. He is my guest for a long time today. The first hour and part of the second hour, Dave Rubin coming up. I hope you saw my interview with Pat Boone the other day. I love that man. I love him. He's 85 years old, and I just love that guy. Of course, I've known him about him since I was a kid. Now, the privilege of knowing him. But what we did, they aired it on TBN this weekend, and of course, we aired it on this program last week. We'll probably air it again on Wednesday, and you can watch the video at our YouTube channel, The Eric Metaxas Show. But Pat Boone and I together were calling on people across America to really take this Thursday, the 7th of May, very seriously as a national day of prayer. If you're able to fast, I mean, some people fast for days, but if you would just fast on May 7th and really pray, we are going to take that day really seriously. I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do, but really, really pray for miracles. We need miracles in this country. You know that. We need all kinds of miracles in this country. I won't go into too much of that right now, but some people don't believe in miracles. Let me tell you, I've seen miracles. I know I've written a book on miracles. It happens to have the title Miracles. And I have experienced miracles. Now, they don't happen every time you pray. But when you see one or two or you experience it, you pray differently. You pray with more faith. So we're going to be praying, and we have been praying, that God would do miracles in America. We have so many problems. Obviously, this shutdown is lunacy. Our economy is it's horrific stuff. So I want to say this Thursday, and you can be praying all week long for this country. It is the National Day of Prayer. So I want to encourage you to do that. A couple of quick things, actually. Man, we have, first of all, I want to remind people that we have some sponsors that have been very good to us. And we want to remind you that during this tough economic time, we hope you'll support them. Obviously, Mike Lindell of MyPillow. If you go to MyPillow.com, everything there is discounted with our code, Eric. You have to use the code Eric or Metaxas, but we think Eric may be shorter. We're not sure. Eric or Metaxas. And Honor Bound Coffee, same thing. Now, Chris, you and I, Chris Himes, my producer there.
Yes, sir.
You and I created a commercial.
Yes.
A very funny commercial for honorboundcoffee.com.
Yeah.
And it was so good.
It was legitimately so funny. Yeah.
That it was all about Joe Biden. And I mean, it was funny. It was funny.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so good that I sent it to Pete and Seth Talbot at honorboundcoffee.com just to let them know
that we're trying to
be creative and do crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And they said with many apologies that we had to take it down.
Yeah.
They're getting some political backlash or something. It was so funny. So we're going to make another one.
Yeah. The spot and had a partisan flavor. So it was a little partisan,
but it was much. It was so funny. Some people saw it. I always tell you, folks, I sent out these emails on Friday. You should have clicked on it. I'm telling you. But
We'll put it on the dark web. Apparently, there's some place called the dark web, and that's where all the bad things go.
That's what we'll do. That's exactly what we'll do. Yeah. But anyway, honorboundcoffee.com, they give all their profits to military families. We want you to think about that, folks.
I'm enjoying a pitcher full right now.
A pitcher of coffee, Alvin, that might be too much. You might start bouncing around. But seriously, honorboundcoffee.com, it's a sponsor. We're going to make another ad. That's our promise to you, the viewer and the listener. We're going to make another ad. It can never be as funny as the first one, but it'll be so close you won't be able to tell the difference. Honorboundcoffee.com give all their profits to military families. I still can't believe it. Pete and Seth Talbot, they're about as stand-up guys as you get. I mean, Mike Lindell's a stand-up guy, but he's a mook compared to the – just kidding. It's a pretty wonderful thing that the people behind these products who are our sponsors are people that I personally admire and think are heroes in our time. So honorboundcoffee.com and mypillow.com, big sponsors. And as you know, we often partner with people to do fundraisers for those who are needy. The Bible speaks very clearly about caring for the prisoner. And as many of you know, one of my friends, a man that I admired greatly and then had the privilege of befriending, was the late Chuck Colson. He founded something called Prison Fellowship to bring the good news of Jesus into the prisons and to do the kinds of things that we're commanded to do by God, to care for prisoners, to be concerned about their families. Well, one thing that Prison Fellowship has always done, or I shouldn't say always, for a long time they've done, is reach out to the families of those who are incarcerated. And you can imagine how tough it would be to be inside prison and to know that your family can't count on you for anything. You can't do anything for them. You can't put your arm around them and comfort them during a time like this. Got to be tough. So Prison Fellowship, normally at this time of the year, we would be doing a fundraiser to send the kids to Prison Fellowship Angel Tree Camp for a week this summer. Well, because of this weird shutdown stuff, that is not happening. So Prison Fellowship came up with an alternative idea. They are going to be sending Angel Tree packages, and we need your help in doing that. Actually, Jim Forbes, who's with Angel Tree, he's recorded something. Why don't we play that recording?
Kids all over the country, all 50 states, who their parent while in prison said, you know, I really want to help the relationship, my son or daughter, and I'd like to give them a gift. So the kid receives the gift, and it doesn't say from Prison Fellowship. It says from mom or dad.
Now listen to this, folks, okay? You go to our website, metaxastalk.com. Listen to this. If you donate, for example, $200, because right now during this coronavirus, this weird shutdown, you think, what can I do? How can I help? Now, some of us can help, right? If you donate $200, the Angel Tree folks will send a care package with $150 in grocery gift cards. Also, a choice of some kind of sports equipment, an age-appropriate Bible like the Zondervan Pathlight Campers Bible, some Bible study aids, and a note of encouragement. This is a great idea. Leave it to the folks at Prison Fellowship and Angel Tree to come up with an idea like this. If you want to help, go to metaxastalk.com. We need your help. They need your help. This is what they do. This is how they care for the families of prisoners. It's the right thing to do. If you can help, we encourage you, please go to metaxastalk.com. We're going to figure out what we can give you. Signed copies of my new book, Seven More Men, which is just out. We'd love to do that, but you have to go to metaxastalk.com and give what you can. This is very important. This is it for some of these families. I want to tell you, this is a very, very tough time. You can only imagine, folks, you can only imagine that they can't reach out to mom or dad, and mom and dad cannot reach out to them because of where they are. So we need your help in this. This is a beautiful idea, and we're thrilled to get behind it. As I mentioned, in a couple of minutes, we're going to have Dave Rubin. I can't believe we finally got Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin. Yeah, some of you know, you're like, whoa, I'm paying attention to this. Dave Rubin is going to be on with us in a few minutes. Don't forget that this Thursday is the National Day of Prayer. We're going to take that really seriously. So we're warning you, it's going to be fun. It's fun to see God move. And when people pray hard, you're going to see stuff happen. So we'll be right back with Dave Rubin. Don't go away.
Is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
Hey there, folks. As I warned you, we are now talking to Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin, welcome to the program.
I hope this was the most intense warning you've ever given, because I am highly caffeinated. I've been up since 4 a.m. talking, and I'm ready to roll.
What time is what part of the world are you in?
I'm in the People's Republic of California.
Very early there.
Yeah, it's I started on Fox and Friends literally at like 3:30 this morning, and have done a bunch of stuff since. But you this is a good set of problems, man.
You got it. Look, I'm a writer. Okay, so when a book comes out, it's a big deal. You do what it takes. So, Dave Rubin, I hate to tell my audience what my guests should tell them. So let me ask you like the most basic softball question. Your book is titled "Don't Burn This Book." What is this book about? What's on your heart?
Look, the main thesis of the book is that good people, decent people, are in what I would call the political closet right now. Almost anyone who doesn't fully subscribe to sort of woke progressive dogma are finding themselves stuck and not saying what they believe. And I'm not talking about radical beliefs. I'm not talking about not that there's anything wrong necessarily with radical beliefs, but I'm not talking about racist beliefs. I'm not talking about bigoted beliefs. I'm talking about people that are afraid to say things like, I'm for low taxes. And the reason that they're afraid to say it is, and I hear this on college campuses all the time, a kid will come up to me and say, Dave, you know, I'm afraid to tell people I'm for states' rights or low taxes. And I'll say, well, what do you mean? And they'll say, well, if I say that in class, the teacher or the other students will say that I'm racist. And at first I didn't understand that. And then they would explain the same thing. And I heard this hundreds of times. They'd say, well, if you say you're for low taxes, that means you don't want to help poor people. And if you don't want to help poor people, that means you don't want to help black people. And if you don't want to help black people, then you're racist. So it's this crazy leap of series of things that don't really make sense. And you can explain to these people that there are more poor white people than black people. You can explain to these people that the welfare state doesn't work and it causes intergenerational economic depression and all of the rest of it. But what has happened is the progressive groupthink and the Twitter mobs and outrage culture have caused a situation where decent people are afraid to lose their job. They're afraid to get kicked out of college. They're afraid to talk about basic political beliefs that were mainstream beliefs 20 years ago with their family and friends. And what this book is, I would say, a guide to defeating that, because I was a hardcore lefty. I was a progressive on the Young Turks Network. I woke up to it. And I think what put me on the map more than anything else was over the last 5 years, I was just open about my political evolution. At first I was saying, hey guys, as lefties, we got to start being liberal again. We got to start fighting for free speech and open inquiry and the things we purport to believe in. And then suddenly that led to talking to, you know, those scary conservatives and libertarians and finding out that you're not going to believe this. They're not that terrible.
Okay. I'm glad that you talked about your political evolution, because I was going to ask you, how did you get to be who you are today? What's your story growing up? What kind of a home were you raised in? Tell us a little bit about that, because people want to know, you know, how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, because when you write a book, you have to dive in as deep. If you're going to write something decent, you have to dive in as deep as you possibly can go. And, you know, for somebody like myself that talks about my political beliefs all the time, it's not that I talk about my personal life a ton. So I found that diving into some of that stuff was more difficult, but I also found that it was more rewarding, because it actually helped me understand my own picture a little bit more. So I grew up in New York. I was born in Brooklyn in 1976, before it was cool Brooklyn, you know, and it was just old Brooklyn. And I grew up in Long Island, and I lived most of my life.
Where on the island?
On Long Island, Syosset, Long Island, exit 43 on the LIE.
Dude, I was born in Queens. I spent a lot of time in Belmore.
Oh yeah,
we're from the same neck of the woods. So
yeah, so Long Island. There's a certain something to Long Island. Actually, there's a reason that so many famous people, actors, comedians, authors, artists, came from Long Island. I mean, right. the litany, especially comedians. There's a reason for it because.
Yes.
When you're in proximity to New York City, but not in the city itself, and it was most of the people, when you look at like Billy Crystal and Jerry Seinfeld, they were just like this ton, Rosie O'Donnell, a ton of these comics. And the reason was proximity to New York City, and then also many of them were first generation suburb kids. And I think that that growing up finally like sort of okay, out of the shtetl, so to speak.
The
shtetl of Brooklyn, yeah. I think that that actually caused a certain vision of the world to shift. So there's a ton of interesting people that grew up on Long Island for, and maybe it has something to do with the famous Long Island water too, but something like that. But I would say my family was mostly what I would call old school liberals. Liberals, not in the modern sense of liberalism, but liberals in sort of the JFK, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I'm sure you remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan was our great senator. In Democratic liberal senator in New York. We had Ed Koch was the mayor of New York City. These were good liberals. And I would say that was very much the type of upbringing I had. We used to argue about everything. I write about this in the book. My family, we would, every holiday, it was people screaming at each other and fighting it out, and then dessert would be served and everyone would forget about the argument, and that was that.
Well, so, if you're a Jew, a Greek, or an Italian, you get that. I'm Greek. I get it. We show love by screaming at each other. And by eating and cooking, but so you obviously grew up in that kind of a world where you're sort of.
Wait, we should stay with that. We should stay with that for just a second because I actually reference that very thing in my book. My two best friends growing up, Ari was Greek and John was Italian, and Greeks, Jews, Italians, anyone that came off the boat, you know, and that ended up sort of in Brooklyn or in the Lower East Side, you know, all, that whole thing. It created something actually very special because it was exactly what America is supposed to be. All of these people who came here with nothing, came here with their own traditions. So I'd go to Ari's house and eat spanakopita, and I'd go to John's house and put the mantle on the Christmas tree, and they'd come to my house and have latkes for Hanukkah. And we had different traditions, but our parents believed in sort of the same idea of America and the rest of it. So there is something really special out of that Brooklyn thing that then spawned all of these people into the suburbs. And I think a lot of that, I didn't really realize it until I wrote this book, but I think a lot of what you're talking about right there is exactly why I'm okay listening to people with other opinions. Not just okay with it, I thrive in it, I like it.
Well, what's interesting, first of all, let me quickly ask you, why is the book titled Don't Burn This Book?
Well, the short answer is that originally the title was Why I Left the Left, and I started writing that book because it's a phrase that's been attached to me. And I quickly realized I don't want to write a book about what I'm against. I want to write a book about what I'm for.
Right.
Don't burn this book. I mean, the idea really came around because what I think I lay out in this book are pretty common sense principles. I don't think anyone, even for the people that really disagree with me on certain things, I don't think that the average person would look at this and go, oh my God, it's so inflammatory and whatever. That being said, there's a certain set of people that do find common sense very inflammatory.
Of course.
And right now I've got an army of trolls and haters that are trying to destroy all our Amazon reviews and the rest of it. And of course they haven't read the book, but they've dedicated their lives to just stopping ideas that they don't like, which is ironically the very premise of the book in the first place.
And ironically, it's called fascism. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a great audience. Okay, now I want to ask you, what did you think you wanted to do when you grew up? In other words, now you know, you're out there talking about issues all the time. What did you think when you were a kid growing up or in high school and college? What were your plans?
I wanted to be a comedian. I mean, you can look back at my high school yearbook and everybody said, you know, you're going to be the host of The Tonight Show. That was the thing. And I did stand up in New York for about 12 years with the successes and failures of all of that. And then I eventually got a show on Sirius XM and that sort of led to everything else. But I've always enjoyed it, just sort of engaging with people. Even now I do stand up. I don't really consider myself a stand up anymore, but because I can draw a crowd now because of my other successes, I'll go to a club, I'll do an hour, And I'm not even really doing stand-up. I get on stage and I'm sort of like, hey, how you doing? And let's figure out something funny over the course of the next hour. So
yeah.
I'm much more interested in, you know, they always say this about any artist. It's like when you need it, it's like that will drive you very far. But at some point, you got to not need it to really flourish, something like that. And I think, fortunately, at the moment, I think I've gotten to a place like that. I can do stand-up just for fun now. And not because I need it or because I'm using it to get somewhere else, which is pretty freeing.
It's I mean, I knew obviously you were a comedian, but so going way back, like that's what you wanted to do. Who were your, you know, favorite comedians then growing up?
So the one really that was my true formative comic was Bill Cosby. I remember watching Bill Cosby himself. This has got to be about 1983, I think it came out. And I was about 7 years old. And I remember watching that thing in my parents' den. And you know that type of laughter when you are in pain, when that those stomach muscles are convulsing.
Right.
You know, he's doing the chocolate cake routine and the famous dentist routine and the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is the funniest man alive. I could not believe anything
right.
could be this funny, this joyous. Now it's a little, you know, over the last couple of years, what's happened to him is sort of depressing.
I don't know what you're talking about. We're going to go to a break. We're going to be right back with Dave Rubin. I know you won't go away. Why would you? Christian best-selling author and speaker Richard E. Simmons does not shy away from the big questions of life. His latest book is called Reflections on the Existence of God, and it tackles the biggest question of all, does God exist? I've read this book, and I got to tell you, I'm a little biased, but you can imagine that I like it a lot because Simmons offers insights for those grappling with life's biggest questions. Where do we find meaning in life? Who determines what is evil? Can we be moral without God? Does God even exist? Former White House aide Wallace Henley says, I've taught apologetics for many years and I've read every scholar mentioned in this book. Of all the books on apologetics, Simmons is the best I have ever read. This book is easy to read because it's divided into a series of brief essays, perfect for a devotional or discussion with a friend. I highly recommend that you add a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God to your pandemic reading list. Simmons asks questions that speak directly to one of the most important things you possess, your worldview. Folks, you know how important this is to me. Your worldview is going to impact the way you live your life for better or for worse. If you want to challenge yourself to spiritual and intellectual growth, and I hope you do, then be willing to ask yourself life's toughest questions. Dive in today by picking up a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God right now. Go to existenceofgodbook.com. That's existenceofgodbook.com. Hey there, folks. I am talking to Dave Rubin. I think that's a pretty cool thing. Why don't you listen in? Dave, are you still there?
I'm still there. I like how we cut to commercial. Just as I was telling you, my hero was the largest serial rapist of all time. That was excellent timing.
Yes. Not that there's anything wrong with that. We're not here to judge. Everyone has different standards, okay? We're not here to preach or whatever. If you want to drug people and you know what I'm saying? You understand what I'm saying, Dave?
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Who are we to judge? Okay, so you grew up on Long Island wanting to be a comedian. Besides Bill Cosby, are there any comedians, for example, that didn't drug and take advantage of people that you looked up to?
Yeah, Carlin. I mean, Carlin, in terms of like my real formative years of comedy, so Cosby was the one that got me interested in it. But Carlin, to me, I think, and most people think, he was the greatest stand up in terms of the entire breadth of work. You know, there's always this debate between the Carlin people and the Richard Pryor people. And Pryor obviously was wickedly brilliant too. Pryor went into himself, sort of doing psychoanalysis while Carlin talked about the world. You know, as a guy that does politics, like that type of thing about, you know, taking your thoughts and prescribing them to the world. Also, he was a linguistic master. And, you know, he did something like 20 HBO specials. And his last one, which was only months before he died, I think is as good as anything he ever did. So I would say just because of the breadth of work where Pryor only did two or three extended specials, I think that probably gets him over the hump. But that's purely a matter of taste.
It's
Carlin, kind of, to me, is the gold standard.
When you trace comedy, right, it's interesting. You could trace those guys to, for example, Lenny Bruce or even Mort Saul. And it's interesting because it's a totally different kind of comedy. It's not the shtick. It's not the it morphs into commentary, which is exactly what happened to you, isn't it?
Well, I think in many ways, what I try to do now, and if I'm doing a live stream and I'm just sort of off the cuff and I'm riffing and stuff like that, you know, I'm sliding some jokes in there and sort of bouncing around with some of this stuff. That's not really what I do in my interview show, which is drier. But yes, and I love that you said that, because people forget that, actually, that when Lenny Bruce and Carlin was with him, you know, a lot of people don't know, Carlin was arrested that famous night that Lenny Bruce was arrested. Carlin was actually with him. And, you know, they were putting their butts on the line for speech, that they were actually talking about what really is happening. And, you know, in a time right now where we live on YouTube and Twitter and the rest of it, it's like, there's a reason that people care about these new voices, because we've got a media class that is overly polished, that can't say anything true, that often manipulates the truth. And then there's suddenly this YouTube class or podcaster class that it doesn't mean that everyone's right. It doesn't mean that everyone's brilliant, but we're all kind of riffing on what we see is wrong or right with the world.
Right.
And that's very much in the vein of what true comedy is, even if your intention is not to be purely funny.
I want to talk about some of the news of the day, just because today is today and tomorrow won't be today. So let's take advantage of it. Basically, Candace Owens was just deplatformed from Twitter. Is she still off?
So last I heard, yes, I did text with her yesterday, and she confirmed that she is suspended. She tried to appeal, and I guess she's waiting on the appeal. But she can't, from what I last heard from her, she can't access her account or see any other tweets or anything like
that. Okay, I just want to say, she was on this program, was it last week? We talked for an hour. I've admired her for a long time. When I heard that Twitter had, you know, taken her off, I thought to myself, this is like a Boston Tea Party moment. People should be in the streets over stuff like this. This is, you know, I hate to use the word, it's fascist. It's unconscionable and frankly staggering that in the United States of America, we're living through things like this. I mean, imagine Candace Owens. We're not talking about, you know, David Duke. How is it possible? Like, what do you see? I guess my question, if I have a question, is that I worry that Americans are so comfortable that they're no longer willing to stand up and fight and scream and do whatever is necessary to say this cannot happen in our America.
I am worried about that, too. I would say that that's what I worry about probably more than anything. It was the very reason that I wrote this book, because I want people to stand up for what they believe in. Again, even if some of those specific things are against what I believe in, I think it's right and it's your American duty to stand up. As for Candace specifically, the reason Candace is so dangerous to the establishment or whatever you want to call it is that Candace is a Black woman who refuses to play the victim. It's as simple as that. She always talks about a victor mentality and not a victim mentality. So this isn't about the specific tweet. She's a private person. She can tell people to go out. She's not a government official. What I'm more concerned about is that when it comes to Twitter and it comes to YouTube and the rest of it, we're all playing a fixed game and we know it's fixed. This would be like watching the Harlem Globetrotters play the Washington Generals and pretend that we knew who wasn't going to win or who was going to win. You know what I mean? It's like, we know the rules are fixed. We know that they shadow ban. We know that they depress numbers. We know that they push certain numbers. We know that they deboost things and a series of other Orwellian words. So this is where the great debate is happening with the conservatives and libertarians as to whether you regulate or not. I'm still on the non-regulation side, because as dangerous and monolithic as these companies have become, the idea that we would combine them with government would just, in my opinion, just make them bigger and more dangerous and more monolithic, much like, what did we do? We had banks that were too big to fail. What did we do? We made them even bigger. So every problem that government tries to solve makes the problem worse. So we need alternate platforms. By the way, that's why I started my tech company, locals.com. And I think we're solving, you know, I would say 95% of the problems for 95% of the people.
Well, this is just huge stuff. And it's great to have you out there as a voice. If I just think that everyone like you and me today should, you know, tweet something about Candace Owens, and then we should all retweet each other, because this is absolute madness. It's unconscionable. When we come back, we're going to talk about your heroes, Soupy Sales and the Three Stooges, and more comedy. We'll be right back with Dave Rubin.
All my pictures.
Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. In case you're paying any attention, I'm talking to Dave Rubin. If you're paying no attention at all, I'm still talking to Dave Rubin, okay? So please get used to it. Dave Rubin, your book is called Don't Burn This Book. It is just out, and it's doing well, Dave.
We're crushing it. Yeah, we're number one in every relevant category. So I'm very pleased.
You know, if a bigot and a fascist like you and a racist like you could succeed in America, you know, I got
anybody.
There's hope for everybody.
The American dream is alive and well, my friend.
Look, we've lived through the strangest times, and you know this, and I know this. That as crazy as things were with Trump, in other words, with the media going absolutely crazy, and I've seen it. I mean, I'm finally canceling my subscription to the Times because I can no longer bear it. I can no longer read it. But my point is, as crazy as things have been, this COVID shutdown, the idea of the beaches in California and Florida being shut down, this is utter madness. I know you've been talking about that. Talk about that.
Yeah. So look, I'm here in Los Angeles in the People's Republic of California. This weekend in SoCal, it was about 85, not a cloud in the sky. The most quintessential, perfect LA weekend, which is exactly why people live here. You don't live here for the high taxes. You don't live here for the traffic and the crappy roads and the terrible education system. You live here for the weather. That's it, really. I mean, that's why Hollywood came here, right? That's why the industry was born here. It was mostly
And the fecal sidewalks, let's not forget.
That's mostly in San Francisco, but it's on the way. It is on the way because let's not forget that the guy who was in charge of San Francisco, former mayor of San Francisco, is Gavin Newsom, who's now the governor of California, because when you wreck one city in California, you actually move up. That's how it works. But as far as what's going on with the beaches, this is so deeply dangerous. It's crazy. Look, first off, we have flattened the curve. Now, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know every model. By the way, almost everyone on cable television pretending they know every model and every prediction is just making it up. But we know that the numbers are way less than anticipated. That doesn't mean there can't be spikes again. But the point is, we as human beings, and especially as Americans, we cannot live like this much longer. We have to start rolling out some ways so that restaurants can open, maybe at 50% capacity, maybe at 25%, so that stores can open again. Why is it that big stores like Target are allowed to be open, but mom and pop shops that are literally next door?
But don't we all know that the Democrats, this breaks my heart.
Yes, that they want to wreck the economy right now.
Who want to wreck the economy. And also there's this idea out there in the culture, it's mostly a lefty idea, but that somehow we can regulate or we can outlaw death. We no longer have to die or suffer. And until we deal with death 100%, everybody has to stay home. I mean, it's just madness.
I know that sounds kind of crazy. Like some of your listeners and viewers are hearing that and going, that sounds kind of crazy. Nobody could actually believe that. But I actually think you are right. They believe that they can, through government, create a perfect system where nobody will be treated poorly, everyone will be equal, whatever that means to them on any given day, and that we will be able to protect everyone from everything. That's anti-human. It is not possible. I always liken this to Thanos in the Avengers movies. You know, Thanos saw a universe with limited resources, and what did he do? He said, no one's going to do what has to be done. I'll do it. I'll wipe out half the universe so the other half can stay alive. And in essence, that's what the socialists and progressives are trying to do. That's why every time in their bid to build utopia, they kill a lot of people. Socialists will always say, oh, well, we've never had the socialist utopia yet. Because every time it's gotten there, look at Venezuela, look at all these countries that have tried it, you end up killing scores of people and it never works. So I think what they're doing right now that's particularly perverse is they're making it about our health. They're making it about you. If you walk outside of your home, you're going to die. You're going to catch something.
Right.
That is a new, I would say, very perverse version of the control that they want to have over us. And let's just be totally clear, because I think you're with me, that does not mean this thing is a hoax. That does not mean you should not be social distancing. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be wearing a mask. But all of that being said, life is about risk.
I know, but the rebel in me wants to go out and start hugging and kissing people. In other words, the American rebel in me is so angered at this because, you know, the odds are that doing that would be totally fine. In other words, it's gotten absurd. It's kind of like saying until we get up a meteor shield.
Yeah.
Nobody can leave their homes because you could get hit by a meteor and one death. Listen, one
it's
death
worth it.
Many stay home.
That's what they say. It's worth it if we can save one person, which is an insane premise.
Well, of course it is. But it's kind of like, I mean, this is, as you put it, it's a utopianist scheme that you see all through human history. I mean, we can go back to the French Revolution. I would prefer to go back to the Tower of Babel. The idea that somehow on our own efforts, we can reach the heavens. We can do it ourselves. We just need a little more regulation, a little more technology. We will get there. That's kind of what the statist scheme has become.
I think you're quite right. I mean, look, why is it that just because the governor or the mayor of LA, whatever it is, says we can't go to the beach, and we all just sit back and go, oh, well, they said it, so they must be right. They don't explain why you can't really. They don't say, well, why is it that I couldn't have gone to the beach this weekend, sat 10 feet away from people on my towel, and enjoyed the sun and had a nice day? Why couldn't we make sure if you have to wear a mask, you have to wear a mask, or they could have signs up saying how you have to stay away from people? Now, would people not observe it all perfectly? Of course. But there is a little risk in life, and there has to be a risk in life. So instead of explaining anything to us as if we're adults, instead they do what you would do to a child, which is just make a commandment, make an order, and you're going to believe it no matter what. And you know what I think is going to happen here? I don't know if you were a fan of the old G.I. Joe cartoons, where they were fighting Cobra and Serpentor and Destro all the time. But every episode of G.I. Joe ended the same way. Cobra would be trying to do something, you know, something very bad for the world, and it wouldn't work. And then Cobra Commander would say, if I can't have it, nobody can. And then he would try to destroy the very thing he was creating. And I think we're going to get to a point where people are just going to be like, if you push them that far, they're just going to say, well, I'm not going to listen to anything. And then that's when you're going to have a real problem, because then we're going to have a civil law problem on top of what could then be a medical problem.
Well, a viral civil law problem could be like the healthiest thing if it doesn't really go anywhere and become like a real problem. But if people don't stand up to this, you kind of wonder, where are the actual Americans? We're talking, folks, to Dave Rubin. Do not go away.
The full moon is calling, the fever is high.
Hey, folks, we're talking to my favorite Jewish comedian from the shtetl. Here he is, Dave Rubin. Dave, you know, you've really come up in the world. You not only got out of the shtetl out of Brooklyn, you got out of Long Island, and now you're in California. You really are in that vein of comedian commentators that, you know, now you've morphed into somebody who's mostly talking about politics and being funny as you do it. But you still do shtick, you still do comedy.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I was on tour with Jordan Peterson, one of the things we would do is if I had an off night, you know, we'd get to a city a day early, I would book whatever the club was, and we sold out literally every show that I did for about 2 years. And as I said to you before, I just kind of get up there and I wing it and have fun. And when you don't need it, that's the key. If you don't need something, you really can be free up there. And I'm not up there to just drum them over the head with jokes so that I can get a 5-minute slot on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. That ship sailed a long time ago.
Yes, it did.
You know, the idea of being on the Colbert Show or the Fallon Show, that seems so ridiculous and backwards to me.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. It's for people our age, it's sort of sad because, you know, I remember growing up, watching those, even though Carson went off the air, I think in 92, I was about 16. So it's not like I saw the main years of Carson.
Yeah.
But I remember watching some of it. And there's all those incredible stories about Tim Allen and Roseanne Barr and Ellen DeGeneres and Richard Lewis and every comic. If you did 5 minutes and Carson went like this, and you sat with him, bam, your career was made. You got a sitcom. You did it. But,
no
but
pressure.
That ended with Carson. That ended with Carson.
By the way, I just want to give you a comedy tip. If you ever want to really kill, follow Jordan Peterson.
I know it because I've done it.
Of course you do. Like, there's no one more serious. He's so serious that just looking at him, my eyes well up with tears. Like, I'm feeling the Weltschmerz just looking at his face. But I did follow him. We did a thing with Dennis Prager in your neck of the woods about a year ago. And he was so serious with Dennis that when I got up with Dennis, I could not stop doing shtick. And I thought it was because he can be just so painfully serious, even though obviously we adore him. But I just want to say you should do more comedy tours with Jordan.
Well, that's partly why the tour, I think, was so successful, because usually the way the format worked was I would do about 15 minutes of stand up top, just warming up the crowd. Then he would do an hour and a half, and you're right, it's very fire and brimstone. Sometimes he was lighter, but, you know, it's serious, intense stuff. And then we would do a Q&A for about 45 minutes after, where I would really, mainly I was just trying to make him laugh, because if I made him laugh, that they would all laugh. But I will tell you one thing related to comedy and Jordan is that, you know this, a good comic is supposed to tell the truth. So now Jordan's got the truth. So he already has the hard part of comedy, and now you just have to figure out how to make people laugh. And I would notice this, and our tour manager, who was an ex-comic also, he would say, Jordan would start doing something funny. Like, he'd tell a story about like a clinical study about rats doing cocaine, and he would tell you what the rats would do, but it's very funny coming out of him, hearing this. But what Jordan would do is the biggest comedy no-no. I mentioned this in the book, that he would get a laugh, but because his intention is not to get a laugh, he would run right through the laugh. And what you want to do, obviously, as a comic, you got to laugh. What do?
You pause for laughter.
You wait. You let it roll and let it unfurl throughout the crowd. So I did mention that to him a few times over the tour. And by the end, he used to sit there with the laugh. And I thought, all right, I did something okay.
I love it. Wow. That was your mitzvah for that month. Okay, now listen.
Yeah, there you go.
We're going to keep you into the second hour. If anybody doesn't get the second hour on radio, you can go to our YouTube channel, the Eric Metaxas Show. You can watch all our YouTube stuff. The first 100 views are free, and after that, it's also free, but it's the Eric Metaxas Show on YouTube. You can reach us here at MetaxasTalk.com. Dave Rubin, this has been spectacular. You don't go away, and folks are listening, you don't go away, and we'll see you in a minute.